My name is Steve Seeley, and I've been doing this stuff since I first met Trigam Trungpa Rinpoche in 1975, who was the founder of Shambhala community. And so I've been around a little while. And so I've been asked to talk a little bit about what we do here and why we do it. And so it's a real pleasure for me to be invited to come and speak with you all. Most of you have been coming around for a while here. Some are new. I'd like to try and... By the way, can everybody hear me? So I'd like to address some basic points about Shambhala that are, on the one hand, quite basic, but on the other hand, very profound and deep. So, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meditation practice, there's many, many types of meditation. There's Hindu meditations, there's Jain meditations, there's Islamic meditations, there's Christian meditations, there's meditations that don't have any particular religious affiliations or overtones. You know, a kind of mindfulness traditions you hear about these days. This particular practice, and it is a practice because, as you can see, it's not easy to do. Ironically, it's not easy to be here. How ironic is that? And I want to talk a little bit about why that is. But before we do, I just wanted to talk a bit more about the context and the background of Shambhala, which is that this whole tradition goes back to the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago. The Shambhala tradition was originated by the Buddha, and there's kind of a long story about that. And we don't really have time to go into that tonight, but as you probably know, there's many forms of Buddhism, many schools of Buddhism throughout the world. This is one of them. The Buddhas are a great example of what it is to be sane and be awake. So there's certain unique characteristics, or maybe not unique, but distinguishing characteristics about Shambhala as a community and as a practice. And basically, a foundational characteristic of Shambhala is that we see the Buddha's teachings of enlightenment as a societal vision. We see the Buddha's teachings about how to awaken the best, highest qualities of what it is to be human in the context of society, in the context of each other, you and me. There are traditions in Buddhism where people go off individually and meditate for, in some cases, many years in caves or forests or isolated places. And those are very venerable traditions and it's good that some people do those things. However, here, we really feel that the Shambhala teachings are said to have been presented at this time because of the need of the world. In the 21st century, it's a little bit rough up there. And I'd be surprised if there's anybody in this room that didn't feel like things are spinning faster and faster. Which in some sense is the definition of insanity. It kind of feels like our whole society is going a little nuts. And the world has gone through cycles of greater insanity and lesser insanity, also known as war and peace. And the Shambhala presentation is about how we as individuals cannot get caught by the larger insanity around us, but almost more importantly, by our own insanity. Now, there probably isn't anybody here that thinks of themselves as insane. So let me explain what I mean. I've got kind of this quote from Einstein floating around, but I can't quite get to it. But it's, you know, essentially, insanity, from the perspective that I'm speaking of, is doing things that bring us more suffering rather than less. The founder of Shambhala was fond of calling this phenomena picking up the wrong end of the stick. You know, you got a stick and you pick up one end and it brings happiness and joy. You pick up the other end, it brings suffering and misery. And so often, we pick up that wrong end. Why is that? How is that? Well, that's kind of a long story. You can spend your lifetime, many lifetimes, studying the origin of suffering, how suffering is caused, which is one of the Four Noble Truths taught by the Buddha. But essentially, the wrong end of the stick is the belief that the most important thing in the world is for me to be happy. For me to enjoy pleasure. Which manifests in a myriad of ways. And if we are honest with ourselves, we will see that much of our activity, if not all of our activity, is geared towards gaining pleasure, which includes comfort for ourselves, and avoiding pain or discomfort for ourselves. And so we engage in a constant push-pull with our world, of pulling in what we like, what we want, and getting rid of what we don't want and what we don't like. And then just ignoring the rest. This dynamic is a very simple dynamic of pushing away what we don't want and pulling in what we do want creates all of our suffering. All of it. Now I want to distinguish between suffering and pain. So I'm not saying that as human beings we will never, you know, if we solve this issue that we won't experience pain anymore. That's not true. We were born and it was painful. My daughter screamed for 40 minutes as soon as she came out. I don't remember mine, but wow, she was not happy. What did you do to me? Why am I here? And dying is probably not going to be all that pleasurable either. I don't know, I haven't done it yet, but it doesn't look great. And then along the way, we experience sickness. We experience getting older and losing our faculties slowly or quickly. This is the human condition. Suffering is the rejection of the way things are, the rejection of our human condition, the rejection of our situation, of our pain, of others' pain, and avoiding all that. Avoiding puts us to sleep. That is suffering. And really the definition or the definition of suffering, or a more accurate translation of the Sanskrit term, is dissatisfaction, not being satisfied. That angsty, restless feeling of things aren't quite right, or things really aren't right. And so the practice that we did this evening is undercutting that feeling by coming back just to the simplicity of being here. So what are we coming back to? We're coming back to this sense of presence that is not engaged in this push-pull, that is just, okay, here I am. I got pain in my knees or ankles. And by the way, I should say, when you meditate, we're not saying to push yourself too far, particularly if you have injuries. You have to accommodate that and be kind to yourself. But, you know, being simply here with pains, the runaway mind that's just can't seem to stop thinking. The question of who am I anyway? Beyond Steve Seeley, beyond job description, beyond family, beyond everything. Who am I right now? The uncertainty of that. The uncomfortability of the uncertainty of who I am. So in Shambhala we say, or let me put this in another way. So this this mind that thinks a lot, it makes it hard to just simply be here, or makes it hard to simply be sitting at the edge of a quiet lake and just simply experiencing that lake. What is that mind? That is the mind that is completely habituated to protecting this self, protecting this this self, that this illusory self that wants to bring in pleasure and avoid pain. Am I okay? What's going on? Who are these people? Are they going to hurt me? You know, there's a constant flow of thoughts. And it's kind of like a flywheel, like a very heavy flywheel that got started spinning long, long ago. It's very heavy. And it has tremendous inertia. And so when we sit down and literally do nothing, and I like to say that the practice of meditation is learning how to do nothing and do it well. When we sit down and do nothing, it doesn't mean that this flywheel just kind of stops. It keeps going, because we have such a habit of protecting this me. And when we sit down to practice meditation, we start to see this more and more clearly. Now, this isn't a bad thing. We just see this phenomenon called me, or my mind. And the Tibetan word for meditation is gom, which means becoming familiar with, or to become familiar with. And so meditation practice is about becoming familiar with who we are and what our mind is and what it does, like how we create this protective mechanism again and again, moment by moment. The goading energy behind the spinning wheel, protecting ourselves, creating this cocoon of protection, is fear. Being afraid of experiencing pain, being afraid of losing what we want and love, what we crave, fear of being uncomfortable, many, many things. In Shambhala, we say that undercutting that habitual process is training to be a warrior, training in warriorship. And what we mean here is training in the bravery of not doing the same old, same old. Of actually disengaging from the continual protection of this me. And when we disengage, we can start to, connect with something more fundamental to our being. More fundamental than fear, more fundamental than protection, So, you know, it's an interesting question what that is. What is that kind of fundamental state of being that we possess? What is it that's most fundamental to our human nature? If we stop for a moment. Well, when we stop for a moment, we just feel okay. It's nothing more and nothing less than that. It's like supreme okayness. But this supreme okayness is not just kind of, yeah, whatevs. It's actually, this feels good. It feels good to be here. It feels good to connect with the world around me as it is. Not trying to manipulate it or not wishing that it was some other way. As a friend of mine says, expectations are resentments in the incubation phase. Just simply seeing orange and white, hearing the sound of a fan, the whistle of a train, there's something good, wholesome, and worthy in this kind of simple connection with ourselves and our world that is completely beyond any sense of protection and even beyond any sense of me having this experience, this just experience. So this is a very basic and fundamental experience that is available to us at any moment, and it's our birthright as a human being. And it feels good. It's not like winning the lottery, but it doesn't have that kind of sense of excitement. It's just, oh, nice. In Shambhala, we call this basic goodness. Basically good. So in the meditation practice, we practice coming back to this sense of basic goodness. Practice coming back to the simplicity of our breath, which has that quality of coming, going, no big deal, NBD, no big deal. To undermine our addiction to drama. Including current political dramas. I don't know about you guys, but I check the news like 10 times more than I have in years. See what's going on today.
Uh-huh.
So, okay, so there's this kind of fundamental goodness. Where do we go from here? So what? We live in a very busy and in many ways painful world. So what's the bridge there? The bridge is that nothing in this world is separate from that basic goodness. Nothing in this world is separate from fundamental goodness. However, most of the time we don't experience that. We don't see that. We don't feel that. And over time, we come to believe that that's not true. It's like living in Seattle. The cloud cover is always there. I don't mean to slag Seattle, but I lived there 7 years and know what I'm talking about. You know, the sun is always there, right? But if the clouds are there day after day, week after week, after a while, that's the way it is. And so this practice is designed and geared to puncture little holes in that cloud cover so that the sun can poke through here and there. It's like, oh, just for a moment. Oh, here I am. And then it starts again. You know. But for a moment, we're here. Just for a moment. And that's good enough. That's the practice. Just sitting down so that we can experience those moments, those gaps in the spinning flywheel. And go, oh. Perhaps hear a train horn, just as a train horn. You know, rather than, oh, a goddamn train wakes me up in the middle of the night, blah, 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 blah. Even appreciate the irritating quality of it. Or maybe just love it, whatever. So the practice is about slowly, slowly, and it takes tremendous patience and courage and years, for most of us anyway, to reorient ourselves. To undermine this tremendous, deep, deep rut, deep habit that we've built up. And to create the condition where we have more and more opportunity to go, oh, here I am. It. From that place, we can engage with the world, as I mentioned in the practice, with clarity. In other words, a lack of confusion, which is created by push-pull, but so for example, you know, you know, let's say you're with a dying friend, and let's say, and I'm not saying you would approach it this way, but you know, it's just kind of an example. You know, let's say you are in denial that your friend's dying because you don't want to lose them. And so you're saying to them, oh, don't worry, this will turn around, you'll be okay. That's confusion. That doesn't help them. And that comes from our confusion, like our rejection of the reality of what's happening, which means that we aren't as available for them to give them what they need, to help them. When we become transparent, you know, we let go of all of our fears and inhibitions and so on in that kind of situation, then we can be there fully for them, right? With tremendous heart. And so that's where the warmth comes in, because we're like really engaged. And, you know, meditation practice is not about becoming disassociated. That's not the word. What am I thinking of? Not unattached or not attached. You know, non-attachment is often misunderstood to mean aloof. And this practice does not create human beings who are aloof. It in fact brings out our sense of connection, our sense of humanity, and our sense of caring. But it's all fluid. That's the thing, you see, it's all fluid. Because when we're pushing, accepting and rejecting, pushing and pulling, that makes us brittle. It makes us solid, because we're so tense and constantly doing this impossible balancing act. Whereas when we let things come and go, no matter what it means to us, then everything becomes very fluid. And there's a sense of ease, a sense of flow. Yes?
I'm having a hard time.
Okay.
I can't. You know, like I was with you most of the time, because this is a good thing, and it has been a good thing for me. But if you were a group of people, Syrian refugees, for example, say we all practiced meditation, what do you think people would be saying about their experience of that? And how would you frame the way you describe it? Because for me, it feels very first world. First world. And we have this wonderful thing where we get to sit down in an evening and listen to people talk about stuff and have this sort of shared experience about that. But what would it be like if it were a group of people that were in a tremendous amount of pain? Would you say the same thing? Like they could come to a place where they'd say, oh, here I am in the middle of this insanity and that's okay. Or I don't know. So I struggle with that.
It's a great question, and it's a very important question. I was kind of getting to that as well, but would you bear with me for a couple of minutes?
And, I think so.
But I want to fully address the question, because it's critical, especially now. What I'm describing here is a very fundamental description of what it is to be a human being. And we are in very fortunate circumstances here. Absolutely. We have the ability to be comfortable in this room, and we're not afraid of being sniped at, and so on. But my feeling and view about what we're doing here is that this is the way to train for any circumstances, including really, really bad, rough, painful, difficult circumstances. So, you know, an example that's closer to my experience, closer, not close, but closer, is what happened to many of my Tibetan teachers when they were, when their country was overrun by the Chinese, and they, in some cases, spent decades in prison, being beaten repeatedly, prodded with cattle prods. And their description, the description I've heard from some of them about how they were able to go through that experience, and I'm obviously I'm talking about what I've heard from them. It's not personal experience, but what I understand is that in many of those cases, they would feel compassion for their tormentors. They would be able to withstand horrible treatment. In some cases, come through stronger and also use their time. You know, I heard one recently say, well, because I had the practice in my heart, you know, the Chinese told us to, we couldn't do practices anymore, we couldn't do mantras, and they would watch to see if we were, you know, mumbling with our breath, you know, with our mouth, and beat us up if they saw us doing that. But we learned how to do that to ourselves. And so when I say warrior training, I'm not kidding. I'm talking about, you know, how to how we can best prepare ourselves for anything, and how we can help others. So I'm trying to not deny the fact that we have very fortunate circumstances and we're not experiencing what the refugees are experiencing right now. Is this helping a little bit? So, I brought up the question, what is the bridge between this fundamental goodness I'm talking about and our everyday experience of the world? And I think it's just, you know, having a very big mind that we want to I think it's learning how to be a warrior. And again, I, you know, I think of the founder of this tradition, Chögyam Trungpa, you know, climbing across the Himalayas for, I think it was 8 months, losing many of his people. You know, he started out with a crowd of 300 following him, and most died in the journey. What did he rely on? You know, what did he fall back on? He fell back on these teachings. So, to try and kind of address your point directly, it really is critical that we don't understand this kind of vision of basic goodness as sort of a la-la land kind of thing. You know, it's not about relative goodness. It's not about relatively feeling good or being comfortable or anything like that. We are fortunate in that we have the wherewithal to hear these teachings. Not everybody does. And so there's circumstances that are conducive and circumstances that are not conducive. So, do you want to say more?
Anyway, some of my experiences with people who are suffering have been sort of a, I don't know what you call it, you know, just being what word do you use, like transcend or something? I don't know. I guess it makes me think about what Trump said about the people who were the neo-Nazis and stuff like that. He said, well, they're beautiful too. Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought, I mean, if you got right down to it, yes. Mm-hmm. We're talking about basic goodness, then everybody's got it.
Yeah.
So how do I respond? Mm-hmm. to what I'm
right.
what I'm trying to experience and what I'm noticing other people's reactions are? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So I'm confused.
Yeah.
I feel pretty confused.
Yeah. It's difficult. I think the key is, yes, everyone has basic goodness, including the Nazis, including Hitler, you name it, you know. I think the trick is to not kid ourselves, to be very honest about the entire dynamic and how it works. That there is a lot of confusion, tremendous confusion in this world. And it creates tremendous suffering for many people. And not pulling any punches about that. Like, that is the case. That, you know, for some people, that cloud cover is interminably thick, extremely thick. And they cause suffering for so many people. And not, you know, not glossing that in any way and not pretending that, oh, well, he has basic goodness too, she has basic goodness too, so they're not that bad. You know, no. If someone is covered over, they're really covered over. And so you have to be direct with that. You have to be honest with that and work with them on that level. But I guess what I was trying to get to overall is that as confused human beings, we never see the whole picture. We never see the fact that any experience that we have is accompanied by basic goodness. And We tend to make things black and white. You know, it's either good or it's bad or it's this or it's that, or it's left or it's right, or it's liberal or it's conservative, or, you know, because that's how we do the push-pull thing. That's how we define our world. That's how we know where we stand in relation to Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren or, you know, whoever it is, or whatever it is. And so when we're connected with the basic goodness of all beings and all things, then we have a chance to be very blunt and direct about this person that's standing in front of us and their character and qualities, and whether they're causing a lot of suffering or whatever, and to be fearless in the face of that. Because A, we aren't protecting ourselves, and B, we recognize that they have a fundamentally good nature that's very covered up, but it, that undercuts our tendency towards aggression. It undercuts our tendency toward hatred. It undercuts our tendency toward creating more pollution in this world. Or, you know, in that situation, whatever. But, you know, I read an article a month or two ago, and I think it was the New York Times, where the writer was kind of saying that what's happening in the U.S. right now is kind of like an illness, like a virus. The anger is infecting more and more people, is infecting more and more institutions. And it's like an infection. And our choice is to engage in actions and activities that contribute to that infection, to that illness, or that don't. You know, at the very least, not contributing, and obviously, an even better thing is to help heal the illness. And one second. And in Shambhala, we talk about this kind of. This is the relative manifestation of basic goodness in the world, which is that we have a choice every moment to be fearless and proclaim the goodness of the world and be very direct with every situation that we encounter without protecting ourselves, or to engage in the activities and actions of fear, which is a dark road. And you can see these days, you know, the how some people are using fear to get that wheel spinning faster and faster too. Using people's vulnerability to fear. That's how fascism works. That's how fascism is born, is given rise to. Yes, I know. We've got 5 minutes left. Right? I said we'd go till 9.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes. Okay. I do have a couple of events at some point, but I can do them after you finish.
Okay. Did you have something, Gary?
Well, just like you said, taking the challenge, I think it's our responsibility as each person, as individuals, to not continue the habitual patterns from the past. Mm-hmm. And that our first contribution for sanity in this world is to actually enjoy life, respect each other, and be kind. Mm-hmm. And this practice that we do is stopping that wheel of pain in a way, or slowing it down so that we can create a saner world. And it's not frivolous in any way related to the suffering of the world to cause less suffering. It is an act of gentle defiance to that suffering. And the great emperor Ashoka, who lived 2,200 years ago, who spread Buddhism, and all of us know that story, created...
Well, not all of us know that story.
Well, he created great suffering. He conquered many kingdoms.
In India. Right.
And he was the first Indian king to unite all of India. And once he realized after his largest battle that hundreds of thousands of people that had been killed, he felt remorse for what he did and spread Buddhism. So that suffering is not unique to just this time.
Right. Yep. Yep. Thank you. I like that phrase you came up with, gentle defiance.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Gentle defiance. It's good. You should make a bumper sticker. You know, the resist bumper sticker. Right? Gentle defiance. Defy gently. So, you know, this has been a little intense. These are kind of intense times, and you know, who knows where it's all going. But I hope that this is kind of the start of a conversation, or, you know, I'm not sitting here trying to present the law of the land and this is the way it is, period. It's like, you know, what do we think? Like, how does it work? And by the way, anything I've said tonight, you need to examine for yourself and see if it's true or not. This, everything I said could be utter bullshit. It really could, you know. But as said, we need to examine for ourselves and see. There's nobody out there that's going to verify it for us. So, so it is 9 o'clock, and hope you got something out of this.